Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks, set the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is episode 99, it is the 5th of March, and we've got a big show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to, it's going to be an IPA edition, always good. We're going
double
to be talking,
shot, I like to call it.
Double shot IPA, you like to call a lot of things double shots.
I do.
We're going to be talking to IPA research fellow Daniel Wild. He's had a really cool article coming out, it's already out, on the morality of coal. We're going to be talking to him about that, about Scott Morrison's new energy deal, and a few other things. And we've also got Bella DeBrera on, always a favourite here at the Young IPA Podcast. We're going to be talking to her about some curriculum stuff.
Dr. Bella.
Dr. Bella is her name. So let's get into it, Pete. And Nina, are you okay? Because there was a bit of a meltdown just before the show. Nina just started making a lot of weird noises, but we're all good?
Yeah, I'm okay now.
Okay. Are you sure? This will be a fun subplot for the rest of the show. Yeah. All right, Pete, let us talk the big story in Australia right now, which is the Michelle Guthrie payout secret scandal.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't say it's the big story. It's a reasonably large story.
All right, well, I just tried to build you up. I just tried to make sure there was some energy coming into this segment. But if you want to throw it back at me, then...
Well, I mean, I don't like to exaggerate. I think the news exaggerates a lot. Anyway, no, as you did mention, James, correctly, Michelle Guthrie... There has been a story about Michelle Guthrie's... James, shaking
his head. I'm furious. You try and help Pete out.
No, well, I don't need your help, James. Michelle Guthrie reached a resolution with the ABC last week about her payout. So she got the sack last year, as we know, and received an $800,000 termination fee when she did get sacked. And reached with the ABC last week an agreement that is top secret at the moment. And a lot of people are saying that she should reveal what the payment was in addition to her $800,000 termination fee, including Communications Minister Mitch Fifield. Even, James, I noticed the ABC alumni who represent former staff say the amount should be revealed because, of course, it is taxpayers' money.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, with Michelle Guthrie getting that $800,000 termination fee, she knows how much waste goes on at the ABC. She knows there's more that she can shake him down for. So it's a very good power play from her.
Yeah. No, look, well done, Michelle Guthrie. So, I mean, this, look, the ABC constantly ask us why we don't reveal our donors.
Yeah.
This is a good example of them not practicing what they preach.
Yeah, exactly. I reckon for the ABC, the best course of action, you need to just make us promise not to be mad about it. It's like when you've got a bad secret and you're just like, look, I'm going to tell you something, but you have to promise not to be mad. That's what the ABC has to do. It's like, all right, we'll tell you the Michelle Guthrie thing, but you have to promise not to be mad about it. We're just over a barrel. They've got us.
Yeah, the bargaining chip of a 14-year-old. That is...
It's pretty good.
Does it ever work? Like, does that ever work? It's like, well, I can't possibly promise that.
You promise not to be mad. Well, the other one I thought was what you do is you find a way to make an even more egregious waste of taxpayer money, which I think the ABC's got it in them to do. And then... that will sort of take the wind out of the sails when the Michelle Guthrie payout gets revealed.
Interesting.
So maybe it comes out that the Milo question costs a Q&A $250,000 in speaker's fees.
You have a lot of real go-tos in terms of breaking bad news to people.
Look, I'm very used to doing it. Yeah. I'm very used to disappointing people. I know what the ABC needs to be doing.
So apparently, I think Wednesday, there's some estimates meeting in which it will be revealed anyway.
Okay, good.
So we can't talk about it next week. Unless
IPA Communications Director Evan Mulholland, he was on the scene talking about it, said the process should be open to taxpayers due to its significance. To quote Evan, they weren't just fighting about personality clashes. It was that Justin Milne was disputing with Michelle Guthrie the future of their online strategy going forward, and that is something the taxpayers who fund the ABC should be made aware of.
Oh, well said, Evan.
Well said, Evan. So, going to be following this one pretty closely. It's a very interesting story. And all I'll say again is just say, okay, we'll tell you. Promise not to be mad.
Yeah.
Absolutely bulletproof way of doing it.
This is like a PR firm.
Yeah, exactly. The Bolton Gregory and Lowen Arthur PR firm.
Thank you. Yeah. They include me.
What do you have any advice for the ABC on this one?
Nah, just...
Nina's never disappointed anyone in her life.
No, so take me as a chairman.
Yes, of course. The social campaign. Well, you want to plug your social campaigns again?
As we know, that has failed.
because Adebatros. All right, speaking of disappointing people, so we've got a Brexit update for you people out there. So this is the Brexit month. This is a month where there should be a deal coming forward. It's starting to look like there might not be. There seems to be a bit of a delay that Theresa May can pull, and that's going to delay Brexit even more into the future, which is there's one thing Brexit needed. It was more delays and less activity. But I guess a big story development this week would be Jacob Rees-Mogg is starting to look like he's going to extend the olive branch to Theresa May, which is pretty big because Jacob Rees-Mogg, pretty big on Brexit, mm-hmm. I would say. One of the big leaders Brexit of guy. The, yeah, the hardcore Brexiters. Anyway, so...
European Research Group.
Yes, that's the one. And so he scaled back his opposition to the deal for leaving the EU ahead of the agreement next month. This month. So Jacob Rees-Mogg said he was no longer insist on the so-called Northern Irish backstop, which is a huge Brexit thing, be removed as a condition for his support. So, I got to give credit to you, B, because you were saying there was going to be a Brexit this year, but it was going to be such a watered down version that it's going to be like they never left at all.
No, I said it was going to work out well.
Oh, did you?
Yep.
No, that was far too optimistic. Yeah, I said second referendum, which I'm still not saying I'm overcooked on. But anyway, we were talking to someone who said, maybe it was Brendan O'Neill or someone, who said that eventually the Brexit that was going to be passed was going to be such a watered down version that it's not going to be like they left at all. And it does seem to be that even the hardcore Brexiteers in the House of Commons don't want to risk a no deal and don't want to be the people associated with that. So they're going, okay, well, let's just get a Brexit all the way through. So now the group must decide. Dan Hannan, friend of the show, friend of Brexit. He was in the paper in the Times, I think it was, saying how bad this deal was and how these people in the Commons can't turn their back. Quote here from the article, it would keep most of the cost of the EU membership while junking most of the benefits. It would require Britain to cede part of its territory to foreign jurisdiction. It would allow Brussels to control our commerce with non-EU states, even after we leave. That's a reference to the Irish backstop. MPs who believe in parliamentary sovereignty should vote against it. MPs who believe in the union should vote against it. And so on and so forth. So Dan Hannan, not a fan, and therefore me and Pete, we're not fans either.
We're not fans.
We stand by our friends of the show.
That's right. The tone has changed in recent weeks. They're saying the Democratic Unionist Party from Northern Ireland are starting to maybe see how they could vote for it. And of course, this has led to the ERG, the European Research Group, perhaps getting a little bit closer to it as well. And they think that if the DUP votes for it, then a lot of the ERG will as well. And on that basis, it actually might get through. Lots of acronyms.
That was fantastic.
Well, you know, I'm a pretty hardcore political analyst, so.
Even just staring at you across the desk of this podcast studio, I wanted just like a ticker tape from a news thing. It was just such like I was getting the 6 o'clock briefing.
Yeah, well, that's what people tune in for, the hard facts. No, and so there has been talk that it might be delayed till June.
Yeah.
And as Dan Hennon says, you know, a good deal in 2020 is better than a bad deal now.
Yes. I think they're just going to keep delaying it under the hopes that one day we'll forget it ever happened.
Maybe.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Just keep delaying. It's like, okay, we can give you Brexit now. And they're like, what's Brexit? And they're like, oh, don't worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the, as you were saying that before, you know, what did you say before?
I don't remember anything.
Oh, yeah. No, just say, promise you won't be mad. Like another 14-year-old tactic is to just not hand your assignment in.
Yep.
Teacher stops asking for it.
Yep. Exactly. Yes, so. You've graduated.
Yeah. So I've got a little anecdote.
Teacher's retired.
Yeah. They've given up.
He still hasn't handed in his year.
Haven't handed in the assignments.
Simon.
Here's a little anecdote for you, James and Nina. The Treaty of Paris, which started the whole process of integration in 1951, actually the draft text for that agreement wasn't ready in time, and the six foreign ministers just signed a blank piece of paper, and then they put the agreement in afterwards, after they'd finished agreeing on it.
When will you people learn democracy doesn't work?
So I think a few of the foreign ministers are like, hang on, what?
Wait, what did we sign up to?
It's like, you signed it before, you know, anyway.
What's the thing about me giving you 50 bucks every day for the rest of your life? Why did you sign up for that?
Yeah.
All right, anyway. Pete, let us talk something else.
Okay, just something
else. Dealer's choice.
Well, actually, let's do another book pulled for sensitivity because, you know, a couple of weeks ago I didn't know what YA meant.
No, you didn't.
Young adult fiction, but I'm...
No, just young... Oh, yeah, well, YA is young adult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know that now, James. Yeah. And to be honest, it's an absolute cesspool, this world.
It can't be fun. The stories you read, it is toxic out there.
It is toxic out there. It's completely intriguing to me. I want to know more. So, A Place for Wolves by Kosoko Jackson. I apologise if I'm not pronouncing your name wrong. Right, Kosoko.
Wait, before we start this, we just want to say, like... Listeners of the show might remember a few weeks ago there was that book Blood Air that got completely pulled because of insensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's track record and now there's an update.
Yes.
So
thanks for that, James, for that point I was going to mention. just kidding.
Well, you went into the now.
Yeah.
We got to look back.
Yeah, that's
in order
right.
To understand the present.
So as we've said, another book has been pulled. So the reason this has been pulled is because Kosoko Jackson is a black gay man who's written a book with two black gay characters set in Kosovo during the war there. But it's been pulled because there's a Muslim character in the book who is the villain. And, of course, the Kosovo War was a war where lots of Muslims were killed, and it was a terrible time for them. So apparently the victim can't be a... Not the victim. What's it called?
The villain.
The villain can't be a Muslim, and that's what has...
These people are not going to like the Aladdin reboot.
Well,
they're in for a bad awakening when that comes out.
Yeah, so there's a few different angles on this. It's, first of all, it's kind of funny because this guy is one of the people that generally leads these pylons in the young adult world. And he's actually a sensitivity reader for the big five publishers. Now, what is a sensitivity reader? I ask you, James.
Well, you have to read it and then...
feelings.
Yeah, and if they're bad feelings, no book.
That's right. So they've got these sensitivity readers, of which this bloke is one. So the first sort of thing is a bit of Schadenfreude. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Schadenfreude.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. Okay, college boy. So there's that.
I did go to Schadenfreude 101.
It's also part of the One Voice series. So
I like you asking me a question. I answer it. Like, then, all right, nerd.
Yeah. Stop showing off.
Give me a swirly.
I'll flush your head in the toilet. What was I going to say? One Voice. Right. No, Own Voice. Own Voice is this hashtag, this movement for people. So, you know, this movement, you can only write about someone who's the same characteristics as you, you know, straight or gay or, you know, race or whatever. And this is part of that. And it's still being pulled down. On the other hand, it's sort of like, I'm not sure how many Hamlets we're missing out on here. Like, I mean, are these books really that good?
I'm not a big YA fiction kind of guy. Yeah. But, you know, like, books are books. We're not a fan. Like, you know, it's not whether or not it's good or not. It's like, all books should be published. And if you don't like what's in it, don't read it.
Yep.
And certainly don't campaign for it to be removed, because that's just book burning. But the point for me, as you say, is like, because Oka Jackson is black and gay, and, you know, we don't want to get on the identity politics thing, but if a black and gay guy can get thrown down for not being sensitive enough and not being as inclusive enough, then there's very few different demographics and can start to publish books in the YA world.
Yeah, it's a toxic little subculture.
Yeah, so the one that seemed to get him in was like, it was a quote we teed from the book, which was, hey, how about we don't promote or support books about a romance between the victimization of two Americans set during a real-life historical genocide where the villains by the demographic that was ethnically cleansed.
Hmm.
Now, rather than just like reading that tweet and moving on, people have piled on. It's had 164 retweets, which is apparently a sizable number for YA Twitter. Which again shows me, like, this is a very toxic subculture in that, like, very few people can get in on a book and it can get pulled. Like, if 164 retweets is enough to get a book pulled, like, that is not very many.
That's right.
And anyway, the review that, or sorry, this quote tweet then became like part of a review. And the review said, I have to be effing honest. It's a family show. I have to be absolutely effing honest here, everybody. The review starts, I've never been so disgusted in my life. The author proceeds to argue that because of the horrific bloodshed that occurred during the Kosovo War, a lot of Albanians were displaced and murdered by Serbian forces. It's insensitive to center a story.
Yeah.
Now, I want to say, if you know about the Kosovo War and you know about ethnic cleansing, and that book is still the most disgusting thing you've ever read in your life.
Exactly right.
Reassess your morals.
Yeah.
I think the war might have been a little worse.
Yeah.
That's my take.
I'm guessing that actually isn't the most disgusted they've been in their life.
No, I hopefully doubt it.
I think the other thing about this is, if you've got to speak in your own voice, what if you've got more than one character? Do they all have to be?
Well, I think like he could have been safe if the villain wasn't Muslim but was black and gay. But then that's problematic, because now you've got a villain who's black and gay, and that's reinforcing negative stereotypes.
That's right.
So no more villains.
No more. Yeah,
every book should be someone wanting something and then getting it without an even slight fork in the road or a slight bit of obstacle.
Well,
everything should just be Call Me By Your Name.
What's that?
I did not like that movie. I did that on the record. There was absolutely no plot line of that film. It looked great. There was no actual drama.
Well, that's there you go. Take. We'll keep you up to date on all the YA updates.
And any more Call Me By Your Name rants that I may have. And I've got several. Anyway, all right. So another story for you guys. So the Cummington Kids, we all remember that. That was the...
Speaking of pylons.
That was the kids that, like, there was a kid in the MAGA hat who was smiling at the Native American veteran. Turned out it wasn't as intimidating. The guy wasn't exactly a veteran, and the media jumped the gun. And now they're paying the price, because the Washington Post seems to be the first sort of indication that they know that they've been taken over barrel. So they put out an editor's note basically saying, subsequent reporting, a student statement, and additional video allow for a more complete assessment of what occurred as opposed to their story, either contradicting or failing to confirm accounts provided in our initial story. So they're basically conceding they missed the mark on that one. And that's interesting, because now, like, papers are starting to cave, and you think about all the other people that are going to be in the defense booth. I think it's like Alyssa Milano and Jim Carrey, I think, as well.
Really?
I might be getting that wrong, but there's a lot of people in that. There. Yeah, just throw, you know, it's only live.
This story teaches us one thing. It's the facts don't matter.
It's definitely check your facts.
This will never come back to bite us.
Yeah, but I do remember, like, there's a whole lot of celebrities and a whole lot of media organizations that are on the defendant's booth. And Washington Post is one of them, so they're the first one to cave. And Todd McMurdy, which is a very fun name, but Todd McMurdy, the attorney for the kid. They make them walk around. Todd McMurdy, who's one of the attorneys for the MAGA kid, Nicholas Sandman, he says what the Washington Post put out is barely worth comment. WAPO committed gross journalistic malpractice and cannot undo its deeds with an editor's note. So they're not going away because they know how much public sentiment is on their side. And this is going to go on for a while, and I'm going to enjoy every single story.
Well, it is suspicious timing, James, that they receive a legal letter for a big lawsuit, and then a few days later, a bit of a climb down. Now, call me cynical.
Yeah, I will.
Okay. So there's that, and then there's also in this so-called climb down, they did also say we have provided a fair and accurate historical record of how this incident unfolded. So it's also like we're apologising a bit, but not admitting fault because of this legal thing. Yep. I'm no legal, as you know.
Yes. The real problem is Twitter, is what they should say.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what they should
say. If you want to fight us, fight the fact that we like retweets.
And it just goes back to why didn't any of you watch the video?
Yes, exactly. Or just like, you know, wait like 24 hours for more truth to come out instead of just going, oh, you know what? Let's just put this kid on all over the internet.
Yeah, anyway.
All right, cool. So that's it for the start of the show. We'll now go... Ooh.
Trump executive order for free speech.
Pete's got a late one.
Yeah, just a late one. It's just come across my desk in the last few minutes, actually.
That ticker tape. Give me that ticker tape back.
So news just in like a week ago that there's been...
Covington taught us we need to wait till all the facts are out.
That's right.
So news is just in.
This is real journalism. On Saturday, Trump promised CPAC 2019 attendees that he would sign an executive order forcing universities to protect the free speech of their students. An official in the Trump administration has confirmed that a draft exists. It will penalize universities by reducing or removing federal grants if they don't protect the free speech of their students. Trump referenced Hayden Williams, who was punched in the face while helping with recruitment for conservative advocacy group Turning Point USA at Berkeley University as justification for this. And, of course, we've spoken about a lot of the incidents on this show. It was interesting because someone had posted about this on...
Liz Milano is being sued. I was right.
That's good. Glad you checked that because I'm sure she's got good lawyers. And, you know...
She better. She's about to get sued.
Well, that's true. But she could have sued us for, you know, dozens of cents. Anyway, James, someone posted about this on the Melbourne University law page about this Trump executive order, and they were saying, why does the right get this issue? We should also be talking about this on the left.
Yes.
So isn't that interesting?
It is. What do you make of it?
I think that it's good.
You think it's good?
Yeah.
I think it could also be bad.
Okay. Because obviously it's cultural problem versus executive overreach, as we know. So like the problem with free speech is a cultural problem on universities.
Yeah.
And we don't support executive overreach.
No, we do not.
We're against that. Nina's definitely against that.
Isn't she?
Except when she's the executive.
But and there'll be a lot of overreach. There's
plenty of overreach. But
like an iron fist.
What we're this? He's not saying you have to do this, you have to do that. He's just saying, you know, you can do whatever you want, but we will not give you funding. This is what we say should happen. We say there should be less funding for universities. That way they can have whatever policy they want. If they want to say, we're not going to have any conservative speakers on stage, that's fine.
And you just don't get the federal
But they're not getting taxpayer money.
Yeah.
If they want taxpayer money, they have to play ball.
Yeah. But it's just like, I don't know. You give the government the power to do this, you also give it the power to use it against you.
But they're not, they're just taking money away.
Yeah, I know. But like...
Like we want the money to, we want the government to take money away from everyone.
Yes, I know.
That sounds worse than it is. But trust me, things will be better. Trust me.
I just am not a fan of there being a precedent of the government can say what level of freedom of speech there is at campus. Because, you know,
you're saying there should be
Do I trust like Elizabeth Warren or AOC with this power? Not really.
But the government already does with the First Amendment.
But I'm just saying, like, this gives, like, maybe AOC can just say, you know what, this person that doesn't believe the Green New Deal was a good thing under my presidency. They can't speak. Any campus that allows this person to speak no longer gets federal funding. I just don't like that.
Yeah.
It can be used in too many different
ways. But that would be reducing freedom of speech.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, it can be used too many different ways.
Well, it's good that we took 99
There's good
shows.
Arguments on both sides, but I just, the second I start hearing the federal government's, like, you know, taking a close look and at freedom of speech on campus,
It took 99 shows and we finally had a proper disagreement.
let's fight it outside.
Let's punch on. That's how you sort out differences.
There will be no episode 100.
Okay.
Please cancel all the floats. All right, cool. All right, that is on that very antagonistic.
Yeah.
Borderline angry.
I don't know if we're coming back after this.
Violent with rage. Note, we are going to go to our interviews with Dan and Bella. But before we do, hey, thank you guys so much for listening and downloading this podcast. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, any podcast app that you want or any podcast app that your friends and family use. So make sure you are spreading the word about the podcast. But if you are listening through Apple Podcasts or iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star rating. Really helps us out with the show. You can also leave a note if you wish. And make sure you're also tuning in to Looking Forward, the IPA's podcast, which takes more of a deeper, more philosophical, more better.
Open
I'll just say better.
Pretty philosophical.
Well, that got very good at the end there. They take a look, much deeper look at these issues, really talk about the first principles behind all that stuff. So make sure you listen to that. Scott Hargraves and Dr. Chris Berg, Looking Forward. And if you are listening to that through Apple Podcasts and iTunes, make sure you're leaving it a 5-star review. Helps out get a lot of new people to the show. That's all I've got. So, Nina, where can people go if they want to become a member of the IPA or if they want to support our work that we do?
Well, just visit the website, ipadoc.au, and click on the donate button if you like to donate. Or if you work and be a member, just click on the join button, and starting as low as $22 per year, you become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Nina's got a good radio voice today.
Yeah. Well, today, every day.
Well, I just noticed it.
Nina, I like you more than Pete does.
Thank you.
Yeah. So
I
when
like
you come,
you more than Pete.
When you come to power, just remember this moment. Okay. I want to be Secretary of State.
Oh, God.
All right.
Sure.
Okay, we now welcome back onto the show one of our favourites, IPA Research Fellow, Daniel Wild. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we wish we could have you in the studio. Don't know what happened to me there. We wish we could have you in the studio, but you're out on the road flying the flag for the IPA. But we did want to still talk to you because you've had a pretty big week and there's a whole lot of developments on the energy policy front. So let's get into, first off, your article last week talking about the morality of coal and the selective morality of people that support renewables. So basically, what was that article all about?
Well, the article was about, it was in response to a comment made by Richard Miles, who is the Federal Labor Party spokesman for defence. And he said, and I quote, the global market for thermal coal has collapsed and wonderful, that's a good thing. So I wrote an article in response to that, firstly saying, look, it's not true. Coal is still forging ahead. We have 2,240 coal-fired power stations around the world. It's Australia's biggest export. It's a major job creator. So the idea that coal is not a growing and significant part of the energy mix is wrong. But the more fundamental issue here is really the glee in the statement, the desire to see coal go down and the desire to see the market for thermal coal collapse. Now, the problem with that is that coal is actually the lifeblood of economic opportunity and poverty alleviation. So in 2015, we did a report at the IPA which found that, or conservatively estimated that Australian coal could help about 82 million Indians access electricity. And so if we're not going to be exporting Australian coal to India and other places, this means that people in those countries are going to have to burn wood and crop waste and animal dung, which is terrible for the environment and also results in terrible health outcomes like pneumonia and stroke and lung diseases as a result of not being able to export coal, as well as the fact that coal is essential in Australia to providing cheap and reliable energy that is the basis of economic, of sustainable economic growth. So I think the statement by Richard Miles and others, such as Senator Richard Di Natale, are very harmful to the prospects of having a more allowing coal to flourish.
Yeah, it really is a bugbear of mine, Daniel. You know that I'm doing a development economics PhD. My area of interest is economic development in the developing world.
Finished any day now.
I constantly say to people who talk about climate change and how important it is, it's like, what is your plan for the billion people that don't have access to electricity? What is your plan for them? Like, I just don't understand how half the aid advocacy people don't talk about this as well.
No, exactly. And you've done a lot of great work on the ineffectiveness. Well, you want me to say what you've done good work? Yeah, just generally, mate, you've done good work. No, on foreign aid and how it's ineffective. But what's interesting is that the answer to your question would probably be, let's say, more foreign aid. But we already send $4.2 billion a year in foreign aid to lesser developed nations. But the same people that want us to send that aid and want us to send more aid actually want to stop us sending coal to those same nations. It's like, well, coal is going to be a more direct conduit to helping those people get out of poverty rather than sending billions of dollars in aid, which, I mean, who knows where it goes? It goes to the government, but we don't know ultimately where a lot of that aid goes to. It certainly doesn't make it to the front lines of people that are trying to get out of poverty, as and I'm sure you can talk to that a bit more, but that's really the issue. So you're 100% right. There's no real solution. If you want people to get out of poverty, then they need cheap electricity, and the main way to get that today is coal.
Yeah, I think, like, I might be sounding like a bit of a broken record, but another aspect of this is that so many people that, you know, they want divestment from coal, they want to fight climate change right now, there seems to be more of a desire to help future generations than a current one. Like, there's this idea that we owe more to people that haven't been born yet than the millions of people around the world who are already, like, born and are struggling. It's a really weird thing for me.
Well, exactly. And you'll notice I don't care about future generations when it comes to the $500 trillion in debt we have. So it's a very selective application of that idea that they care about intergenerational fairness. And I, of course, dispute the premise. I mean, Australia accounts for 1.3% of emissions on a global scale. Humans account for 3% of all emissions from human and non-human sources. And of course, there's very widely documented concerns about the veracity of the scientific evidence underpinning the whole climate change agenda. So, but even if we accept the premise that, yes, doing something about climate change will help future generations, you're right. What about the billion people today that can't get access to cheap electricity? And what about all the other ways in which we could help future generations, such as not giving them $500 trillion in debt?
Of course, we've talked a little bit about people living in absolute poverty all around the world, but there are people that are living in relative poverty here in Australia. How does not investing in coal impact those people?
Well, there's a few ways. The most obvious is through prices, through the effect. Everybody's electricity bill has gone up over the last decade. Prices are up by about 120-130% over the last decade in terms of retail electricity prices. So it means more of a strain on the household and family budget, and that's going to have a disproportionately negative effect to people on a lower income. We know that it's people on higher incomes typically that are most in favour of policies that will raise electricity prices because they can afford to absorb those costs. Of course, it has flow-on impacts to the business environment and the operating costs of businesses. We know that business investment is around 11.5% of GDP, which is lower than what it was during the Whitlam years. And a key reason for that is high and rising electricity prices and unreliable supply. So particularly when you're operating an energy-intensive business in manufacturing or heavy industry, 100, 200, 300% increases to your electricity bill means you can't put an extra 10 people on. You can't pay, you know, you can't increase wages by more than 2%. You can't reduce the price of your product by 3 or 4%. It has really significant flow-on impacts right through the economy.
So that's the kind of overarching point that I think you and Andrew Bushnell were talking about the other week, which is like there's an economic argument to be had here over coal, but it quickly turns into a moral one for people that want divestment. And the fact is that people who still want coal also have a moral argument to make. So how do we start to win that moral argument once, you know, the economic side is sort of not even argued anymore?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question. I think it gets to what is fundamental to not just energy and coal, but through, you know, why do we want lower taxes? Why do we want less regulation and many other things that we want? We want it because we believe in the inherent dignity of the individual, and that it's dehumanizing for people not to be able to afford the electricity bills. It's dehumanizing to have policy settings that prevent people from starting their own businesses, that it's fundamentally immoral to deprive 84 million Indians of access to electricity because a small number of relatively well-off Australians want to pursue an environmental agenda. So you're right, the moral arguments are far stronger than the economic arguments. And I think the main conduit to those moral arguments is to talk about the importance and inherent dignity of individuals and the way that that is undermined by policies that prevent, in this example, the development of coal, but also other such limited government policies. I mean, the other measure here is actual job creation. I mean, you look at the Adani coal mine, which is based in central Queensland, there's thousands of potential jobs that will be destroyed or foregone if that mine doesn't go ahead. And we know that one of the most important components of human dignity is work. It's such an important part of people achieving financial independence and also being able to form self-sustaining families and communities. So I think talking more about those things will be great.
Fantastic, Daniel. Now, you've also been talking a lot recently about the government's new climate plan. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the new climate plan is called the Climate Solutions Package, which is $3.5 billion being handed out. They call it an investment, but it's not an investment, it's just spending. The main component of that $3.5 billion is $2 billion on what is called the Climate Solutions Fund, which gives taxpayers money to farmers to plant trees to sequester carbon, basically. So it's essentially the same as Tony Abbott's Direct Action Plan. That is the centerpiece of the policy, which is quite funny given they've gone back 5 years to adopt the policy of the Abbott government, but that's what they have. Now, the interesting thing about this policy, and this is something you won't read anywhere else, is this is going to have a really significant negative effect on farmland productivity. So what will happen is there'll be financial incentives for individual farmers to forego raising cattle, raising sheep, growing grain, and instead to plant more trees. Now, it may be in their financial interest to do that because the government's saying, we're going to give you so much money, and the farmer will only forego, say, raising cattle and plant more trees if it's in their financial interest. But what that means for everyone else in the country is we're going to have higher price on beef, higher price on wheat, higher price on grains, higher price on everything that comes from the farmland, and associated reduction to the productive use of farmland. So I'm not sure this is a very well thought through policy. It seems something that's been made up on the run, something pulled out of, you know, the bottom drawer of a climate policy
made up on the run. How dare you, Daniel? How dare you?
Yeah, well, I mean, don't forget, we're the country that implemented the national broadband network on the basis of the drawing on the back of a napkin. So we do have form in this area, but it's not a good policy.
Are you relieved at all, though, that we are on track to meet our Paris commitments in a canter?
Well, I don't know. We are. This is the interesting thing, right? So, that on the one hand, like you say, it's been a talking point of the Prime Minister and the Energy Minister, who is Angus Taylor, saying we're going to meet Paris in a canter. Well, if you're going to meet Paris in a canter, then why do you need $3.5 billion in this new climate solutions package? I thought we're going to meet it in a canter. So apparently we're not going to meet it in a canter. So this gets to a much more deep point, which is the government's message is confusing. When Angus Taylor was appointed Energy Minister, Scott Morrison said he is the minister for getting electricity prices down. But he's not talking about prices now. He's talking about emissions. So now apparently he's the minister for getting emissions down, which is no different to what we had under Gillard or Rudd or Turnbull. So there's a real confusion there within the government about what their messaging is. And this confusion came to a head in an interview that Angus Taylor did with Barry Cassidy on Insiders over the weekend, where they got into a quibble about what is happening with Australia's emissions. And what's so funny about it is they're both right. So Barry Cassidy said, well, Australia's emissions are up 0.9% over the past year. Angus Taylor said, no, they're actually down by about 1.5% over the last quarter. Right, so they're both, and this is based on the same data and the same study, so they're both right. They did come down over the last quarter, but they were off on a yearly result. So it is terribly confusing to have a federal energy minister to be quibbling over quarterly versus annual results. I mean, people's eyes just glaze over, and it's completely missing the point, which is people want to have lower prices and more stable supply, and they don't care about emissions.
This thing of just replacing food with trees, I mean, we've seen overseas the biofuel, the ethanol thing cost, well, sent millions of people into starvation. Has anyone raised that in this debate?
No, mate, you're probably the first one. You should write something off about that. Well, and you're exactly right. That was a big thing in the States, which was, I think, corn.
Yeah, that's one,
instead of being used, instead of eating corn. I mean, you can't eat petrol. You know, you can't eat fuel. So the corn then goes into making the corn goes into making fuel rather than being able to eat it, and it has the associated effect through supply and demand of raising prices. And that's exactly what will happen here. You'll have farmland with trees. I mean, you can't eat trees. So you're going to have higher prices for everything else that would have been produced if the trees weren't there. But unfortunately, that analysis hasn't really been forthcoming.
All right, let's move on to the final topic. So last week in the IPA's Hey, What Did I Miss email, which everyone should be already subscribed to. If not, go to ipa.org.au. But John Roskam shared a graph as part of his staff pick showing it's a graph in the US, and it basically shows that every product that responds to the forces of the free market, specifically televisions and computers and software programs such as that, their prices have fallen a lot since 1998, and then products and services that are involved with, like, there's a lot of government intervention, like college tuition, textbooks, childcare, Medicare, stuff like that, all their prices have gone up. Now, I understand a while back you wanted to find out if the same was true for Australia. So what did you find?
That it is exactly the same. So we analysed around 10 different markets. It was markets delineated by, as you say, high government versus low government regulation. So in the low government, they are the areas, TVs, you know, personal appliances, clothing, other such matters. And in the high government regulation area, there's childcare, education, private health insurance, housing. And so what you find is massive increases in the cost of items that are heavily regulated by government, whereas you've had a fairly modest reduction in the cost of items that are more market-based. And one of the key drivers of that market-based reduction to prices is actually trade. So trade-exposed industries obviously have more competition because you can buy a TV or clothing from Australia or you can buy it from another country, and so that increases competition, which pushes down prices. But there are also sectors which have very limited regulation and they're not subsidised. Whereas we know, for example, childcare, there's a significant amount of regulation in addition to the fact that you have significant subsidies. So the regulation reduces supply, the subsidies increase demand, and you get a very rapid escalation to prices. And that's why the cost of childcare has risen by around 300% in the last 2 decades.
That's such a huge number. All right, Dan, thank you so much for joining us. That article on the morality of coal is on ipa.org.au if you haven't already read it. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on, Dan.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, right, mate.
Okay, we now welcome back one of our favourites here at the Young IPA podcast, and I think her third appearance already this year, so Bella, yeah, really clocking up the miles. Dr. Bella DeBarra, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back. That's once a month, that's pretty good.
Yes, we've satisfied your quota, and boy, yes, if we ever drop beneath it, there will be hell to pay. Let's get into it, because big week for you. You were on ABC Radio Counterpoint talking about literature and gender politics. Apparently, classic authors don't reflect the sexual diversity of the classroom. So what are your thoughts about that?
So this story is about some researchers at QUT who had too much time on their hands. They're in the Department of Education. And they took it upon themselves to go through the suggested reading list of the national curriculum. And they went through each book and they decided that only two of them passed because they have vague references to characters who might have, might be transgender or might be, have issues with their sexuality. And then they discounted every other book on that list because they were too heteronormative. So these are what I like to call sort of offense archaeologists. They're actually going and looking for problems and things. So they've written this paper and they think that the chosen texts just aren't diverse enough, and that they say that any student from the class who might be, wondering about their sexuality or whatever, won't and shouldn't read these books because the issues don't address them personally, which is a crazy, crazy idea.
I'm struggling to get my head around this. Are they assuming the gender of all of these classic literary characters?
Yeah, well, what they're doing is they're looking at something like The Great Gatsby, and they're saying, the main character, Nick, could well be homosexual, so therefore that novel might be okay for a class where there's a gay student in there. So they're assuming, as you say, they're looking at these novels and they're assuming the sexuality of the characters. They're imposing their own norms or they're imposing their own standards on fiction.
What kind of books have they ruled out, Bella?
They've ruled out everything on the reading list except for, I think it was Much Ado About Nothing, and because there's cross-dressing, but I might have that wrong. I'm sure the listeners are going to say Bella doesn't know Shakespeare, but I'm a bit on the fly. And they've ruled out everything else but The Great Gatsby. So there's other novels, some of which actually are very modern. There's a Tim Winton novel. There's other contemporary Australian authors that I haven't heard of. But they've ruled all of those out. Even those novels, because I looked into them, they address class and race, but they don't address gender, so they're ruled out. So this is the problem we have.
This is, to me, like, it's so annoying, because surely the goal of all of this is to express, like, we're all one kind of people, we need to be accepting of all things. But to then turn around and say that a gay student can only possibly get life lessons from The Great Gatsby and not any of the other works because there's not gay people is so condescending, and also it's so divisive. It's saying only gay people can read gay texts and they can't read, like, get any sort of life lesson from anything else.
Yeah, look, it's just identity politics at play again. It's just dividing us all. So, you know, it's dividing the class, really. What, you put all the gay students on one side and give them one book to read and then everyone else on the other? I mean, that's just terrible and strange and humiliating and patronising, as you say. So,
and something that would feel like out of the 1950s as well. It's a complete reversion to how...
It's like sort of segregation, because then you're going to have to start doing it on race, obviously, because there's a couple of the books on the reading list that deal with Indigenous characters, a fictional book, but does this mean that the white kids can't read that one? So do you just pick out, you know, and what happens? Do you pick out the one kid who's Indigenous in the class and put them somewhere else and get them to read that book? I mean, it is insane.
And also, also the idea that, like, gay people and straight people have, like, nothing in common. Like, there's nothing that we share in common.
Exactly. That's right. Yes, but again, you know, it's always highlighting its differences. It's creating this division and this this unnecessary, unnecessary hostility between groups, which is the, you know, tribalism. It's identity politics tribalism. It's very much at play in this. It's actually maddening. And it's terrible for the students because they're going to be missing out on all this great literature if this is actually carried through. If people listen to these academics, you know, it's devastating for people's intellectual growth.
Absolutely. So, Bella, you were on ABC Radio National Counterpoint. If people wanted to go Google that, it's the topic is gender and... literature and gender politics for Bella's long discussion on that topic. But we don't have time. We need to move on. So, Bella, when you and I were texting back and forth about what you might want to talk about on the show today, you texted me that you're angry about the primary school curriculum and International Women's Day. So let's discuss. That's my question. Why are you angry?
I'm so angry. No, I'm angry because I was having a look at the Australian Education Union website just out of interest. And they have a huge... sort of section on International Women's Day, which is coming up this Friday, and I thought, gosh, I wonder what they're doing for that. So I had a look at the school materials that they've come up with, and I tell you what, they leave nothing alone. So the five-year-olds are given activities to tell them about how there's inequality in society, how you know, the girls have it bad and the boys have it good, and it's all this sort of the gender roles and discrimination. These are five-year-olds. They're not letting them be children. They should be children. They should be in class, learning how to read and write, and being children and playing, not being constantly told about equality and rights. And I think, you know, when you look at something like this, we're infantilizing adults at the moment, and then we're forcing children to be adults. We're forcing five-year-olds to try and deal with issues that are very, very much issues that we're having to confront in adulthood. And I think it's just parents really need to be looking at what their children are being taught. So that's my rant.
Fantastic. So what kind of stuff are we talking about in particular? What was the activity which got your goat the most, Bella?
So there's something like, well, there's many activities. There was one where for the older children, because it goes from 5 to up to 12, you have to create a day in the life of a girl and then a day in the life of a boy and compare the activities of each gender and then describe what you notice. So in other words... you know, the girls won't have a good day and the boys will have a great day. And then there's another one for the older students, which they write all these scenarios, which are totally, totally, you know, unreal. So this one says, at school this year, I've been playing with a great group of boys in the playground. My teacher says she's concerned for me because I'm a girl. She says I need to find more female friends to play with.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine a teacher saying that.
Yeah.
You can imagine the teacher going...
Stop playing with the boys.
Stop playing with the boys. Go over there and play with the doll. I mean, it's insane. So it's this alternate reality that they live in and that they're now imposing on the children.
So is this stuff that happens at, is this like a, is this stuff that's happening in government schools or private schools or all schools?
Look, I think from what I can gather, this is any school that chooses to celebrate International Women's Day, any primary school that chooses to be, you know, part of the movement, the teachers will be able to access material and use it at their discretion. So, I mean, I don't know how many teachers are using it, but I'd say there'll be quite a few.
It's probably like a bit too much to assume the five-year-olds are the same thought. But one thing we're finding with university students and the identity politics thing is that it's just not holding up true for students, and they're starting to fight back. Do you have any sort of like faith that five-year-olds might, because they don't know any better, they'll take it now, but as they go forward in life, they'll start to go, hang on, the stuff I'm being taught at school doesn't quite ring true for me?
I hope so. But when you start as young as five, it's difficult to undo that kind of work. But if they have, I think if they have the advantage of coming from a home where the parents are still sensible, then they have a good chance at sort of being able to see through the rubbish and realise what's going on. But, you know, there's a lot of cases where parents are just handing their children over to the state to be educated and not really taking any notice. And I think that's where there's going to be more of a problem.
How many school visits do you do, Bella? Because I know that I think you'd be a great presentation at a high school or primary school to hear from Dr. Bella DeBrera. Do you get out to the schools much?
I did last year. I'm getting out a bit less this year, but because my research has been directed towards universities rather than schools. But I'm hoping to change that and do more this year.
Well, you know, if you'd like Bella to come to your school, email in to Nina and Lohan Arthur at ipa.org.au and we can set it up because Bella hasn't got enough to do, so we need to make sure she's kept busy.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, twirling my thumbs, whatever the expression is.
All right, fantastic. Bella, we won't keep you for too much longer because we know that you are out and about, as is Dan Wilde. You're a woman of the people, with the people, and for the people, getting out on the thing. So, we'll let you go. So, Bella, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Right. See you, Bella.
See ya. Okay, thank you to Daniel and Bella for those interviews. I'm just thinking, Pete, we should get out on the road more. We talked to Dan and Bella on the road. They seemed on top of things. They seemed out and about. They seemed energized by the travel. We should incorporate that into our lives.
Mate, I love getting out on the road.
I'd like to feel energy.
Yeah, or anything. I love to get out on the road. I've been on the road a few times with the IPA and it was great. Haven't been for a while though.
You and I went international for the IPA once. That was a very fun trip.
Ooh,
And we worked very hard.
We did.
Anyway, let's move on to some stories that made us laugh this week. I guess a big one in the world of online comedy, even though I'm not the biggest fan of the Twitter account, but anyway, Titania McGrath.
Is it Titania? What is it?
Right, it's Titania. We've had this...
Not Titania?
Who have you ever met called Titania?
Well, I mean, it's like a fictional character.
I know, but the name is Titania.
Well, you're the first James I've ever met.
Well, and haven't I laid down the gauntlet for the future Jameses? Anyway, Titania, it's clearly Titania, but anyway, Titania McGrath is an internet troll, basically. It's a fake Twitter account set up by like a character of an intersectional feminist, and it just satirizes left-wing positions. Again, I'm not the biggest fan, but she is quite popular.
She's been banned from Twitter a couple of times.
She has, yes. And now that she's got a book coming out called Woke, A Guide to Social Justice, there seems to be this weird campaign to expose who the person is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite know what that's going to gain.
Or even how you do it.
Yeah. But anyway, so like, you know, there's journalists really sitting around thinking, all right, whose jokes does this match up with? What's the rhythm and timing and who would do it? A few people get thrown forward, Chris Morris and Ricky Gervais, they're the famous ones. And Colt is apparently in the mix. But anyway, the lead candidate, I guess, is this woman, Rosamund Irwin. Anyway, or Lisa Graves seems to be another person, but I think it is Nina. Mm-hmm.
Why?
Just because you're mysterious.
This is your opportunity to own up.
Pete and I don't quite know what you do when you're out of the podcast booth. And it isn't like it's possible that you're running a Twitter account. Are you the internet satirist Titania McGrath?
Why do you want to know?
I just want to know.
Don't know. What, how many
I just want to know more pieces to the puzzle that is Nina. Because you confuse us, terrify us even.
Well, to be honest, I confuse myself.
Maybe you are Titania McGrath and you don't even know it.
I might.
It's a Fight Club situation.
This is very evasive. Yeah. She's not denying. She's not confirming. How many followers does this person have?
A lot. That's
that's my stance, peeps. Not convinced.
All right, well.
So we're starting another, this is probably our third social media campaign about Nana.
Yep. One a week.
Is she
we're now at one
Titania
a week.
McGrath?
Titania McGrath. We're now at one social campaign a week.
Because we didn't get the chair of the ABC, unfortunately.
What, not ruled out yet?
Oh, no, she's been officially.
Oh, damn. Okay.
I think.
All right, well, next time. Anyway. Put it on ice. Don't abandon it. Put it on ice.
So you got, this is your final chance to say yes to the world. I am.
Yeah, the radical person. Feminist slam poet, Titania McGrath. Nina Law and Arthur.
No, I'm not saying anything.
Okay.
She won't talk to, she needs to talk to her lawyers first. Pete, what have you got?
Well, James, what I would like to talk about is...
That's a good question.
An issue close to my heart.
I know I've really stumped you here with the question of what do you want to talk about?
Sometimes silence is golden. No, what I want to talk about is North Carolina. They've dropped their F grade. There's a proposed new legislation to drop their F grade, F of fail, to 39%. So below 40%. It used to be 60%, which to me is way too high. And they've put legislation before the legislature there to make it under 40. And if passed, this bill will come in 2019/2020. My first response to this is good.
Yep. My first response was I have an announcement to make. I am moving to North Carolina.
Yeah.
Yep. Sounds good to me. I also like the idea of, the scalar system will not affect students who are already performing well, but students who are underperforming in school, this is from the North Carolina, from Fox News, students who are underperforming in school will be allowed to continue if passed. So basically it's just like, well, too many kids are dropping out, so we're going to lower our grades in an order to pass them.
Yep.
That'll learn them. Like, that'll fix the problem.
It's hard to teach these kids.
Yes.
So why don't we make it a bit easier?
Yeah. Instead of, you know, thinking about what teachers could do differently or how schools can adapt to suit other needs, it is bury it under the carpet.
Yep.
And yell out, look over there.
So it sounds like it used to be 60 in, or it is 60 at the moment in North Carolina. It's 60 in most states in America.
Yeah.
Which is higher than Australia. Australia's at 50. That's probably why America rules the world.
What are you trying to prove, America?
Yeah, settle down, America.
Weird flex.
So, yeah. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on that. If that passes, we'll continue to keep you updated as we always do.
As we move this podcast to North Carolina.
On the big issues.
Yes. Okay, I've got one for you guys. So, another thing coming out of the UK is Count Dankula's back in the news. Now, if you guys don't remember this, so Count Dankula's is another internet troll, not as witty as Titania McGrath, more of the just troll kind of face. But he got in a lot of hot water because he made his girlfriend's dog do a Nazi salute, and that got him hauled before the courts. And it's like, you know, no one wants to see a dog do a Nazi salute, but nor does anyone deserve to go to court for like something so stupid and innocuous as that.
Still hasn't paid the £800 fine.
And nor shall he. But anyway, so he was going to be on a BBC Scotland TV show. It's like a panel discussion, you know, Q&A, but obviously like a lesser version where Count Dankula gets invited. That causes a huge stir, and then... the show's called The Collective. That causes a huge stir.
Bit of a giveaway there.
Yeah. And now Count Dankula's been axed from the show and a whole lot of controversy, and people just do not learn their lesson.
No, they don't.
Because the lesson was, if you put people like Count Dankula in the court and you make a whole big fuss about what he did, I go from not knowing about Count Dankula to now knowing about Count Dankula. Mm. And now with this story, I've gone from not having to think about Count Dankula for months, and I was very happy with that, to now I have to think about Count Dankula again.
Yeah.
You make him famous. Please stop doing this.
And a large part of his shtick is, you can't say that.
Yeah.
I can't say anything.
Oh, what? Your problem? Your problem? You triggered by what I said? It's like, yes, dude, what you said was terrible. Like, you know, anyway.
And so he's not on the Collective anymore, which says it has a broad range of contributors and robust editorial review.
Yeah, it does. And then it also says he was set to appear alongside dominatrix Megara Fury and reality TV star James English. So I bet the last thing they wanted was controversy in the news. But the last thing, they're like, oh, God, we're going to have such a great debate. But suddenly the news got involved and caused a whole lot of stir and controversy. It's like, you feed the beasts when you do this stuff.
I want to hear what the dominatrix has to say.
I'm sure you do, Pete. But anyway, like, that is the thing. It's just, there's obvious... bait like Count Dankula and shows like The Collective that can only exist when the other side gets really offended by what they say. And if you stop paying attention, they go away. So stop paying attention.
Of course, the other side of this is I'm sure they've had actual communists on the show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's true. But it's, yeah, to me, it's just like, if you want them to go away, don't fall for it. Just ignore it.
That's right.
They lose their power.
So, speaking of people, I can't find a single segue.
That was incredible. I was hoping you were going to land that one, but I didn't think you had it in you.
No segue. Next story. Senator Cory Booker
Seamless.
is a Democratic presidential candidate, as you probably know. Mm-hmm. And he was on the telly this week, and it actually turned out, sorry, I just have to get my phone up for this one because it's on there. It turned out he doesn't know much about drinking.
Yeah.
So is he fit for office, James?
I don't
think so. That's what I ask you.
Well, Trump doesn't drink. So really? You know, maybe.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe this is a whole brand new world where drinking—that's weird. In America, not drinking gets you into the highest office. Mm. In Australia, if you can't knock one back, then God help your political career.
Oh, they just have to practice sculling. Remember, and like the Kevin Rudd went to a strip show thing, strip club.
That would be
polls went through the roof.
Night out, going to a strip club with Kevin Rudd. That would be beyond weird.
Well, yeah.
Two activities I don't quite want to do: go out with Kevin Rudd. Go to stream. Not for me.
Keep going. Pete. Tell us more.
No, I don't really want to.
Okay, so Cory Booker said he had no idea what's in a Manhattan. So they're asking him about his drinking because he doesn't drink and he's a vegan. And he said maybe rum, vodka. And that was like, no, that's not true. He also said he knows what's in Long Island iced tea because his dad knows, his dad used to drink them. And that in Long Island iced tea is iced tea, which is also not true. There's no iced tea in Long Island iced tea. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, and to be honest, like, I didn't know that either.
I think eventually they got to, like, a vodka and soda and he got that. Well, so this is big
vodka
news.
Soda. What could possibly...
In the United States?
Yeah. What's in a rum and Coke?
Well, yeah. I mean, what is in Coke?
Who is to know?
My uncle used to always say, that's just rot gut.
Probably is.
Yeah.
But I'll still drink it till the day I die, which might be earlier because I drink a lot of Coke. Anyway, what I was going to say about this is the Democrats, they need someone to appeal to middle America. They need to get back the people that Trump won from the Democrats. And whom's better than the teetotaling vegan Cory Booker?
Yeah.
Who will be able to throw down with the working class people of Philadelphia than a guy who's like, is there any vegan products in this? Like, was this ever part of an animal? I can't eat it.
Well, of course, Elizabeth Warren had a beer in her thingo.
Oh,
video
don't I remember that. That is the most excruciating video I've ever seen.
But these drinks, they're not even like, it's not like what's in a Budweiser.
Yeah.
It's like what's in this drink that these people you're trying to attract don't ever drink.
Yeah.
And the other thing is.
Yeah. Again, like the working class of Philadelphia is like, that man doesn't know what's in a Long Island iced tea.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, we don't know what's in it. And it's meant to prove that he's not a man of the people, obviously.
Yes.
But I'm not sure it's done that.
Yeah. Well, it's BuzzFeed, so I'm assuming they were just trying to get some internet gold content of like, you know, I don't know if it was BuzzFeed or someone else, but it was like when Kamala Harris played a What's on Her Groove playlist, and it's just like they really want these Democrats to look cool, and they just can't because they're politicians, and politicians, as a general rule, are not cool.
Mm, which I'm fine with.
Yeah.
I'm happy for politicians not to be cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, always with the booze.
Hey, speaking of uncool politicians, now that's how you segue, Pete. Liam Fox, who is the Secretary of State for International Trade and President of the Border Trade over in the UK, so big fish in the Brexit scene. Like, you think about how many things are going to come down to trade deals.
Yeah, that's
this true. Guy is a guy you want at the helm and you want him making good decisions, which apparently he can't do when it comes to podcasting. Now, he spent a lot of... he wanted to do a podcast called Local to Global, which is hosted by a star from the UK version of The Apprentice, Nick Hewer, and it's designed to encourage British firms to export after Brexit using a blend of personal stories and memorable moments.
That's always going to be a tough sell.
I nearly fell asleep just saying that, and that was rough. Anyway,
tough.
He spent £107,000 of taxpayer money on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me give you a quick peek behind the curtain of the world of podcasting. £107,000 is an enormous amount of money.
What could you possibly spend
on? It's incredible. Like, I reckon our equipment costs somewhere around the grand mark, I guess. I don't know. You've got to factor in, well, this is all stuff for Saul, but certainly not £107,000. No. We did not use that much. Anyway, here comes the punchline. It was downloaded 8,400 times.
Ouch.
That's rough for a 6-part series. That is very rough. Again, quick peek behind the world of podcasting. Last year, we clocked up over 100,000 downloads, and we're on track to blow that out of the water this year. So if Liam Fox can get £107,000 for a podcast downloaded 8,400 times, We got to renegotiate our salaries, people. Like, there's so much money there.
Did I hear you say strike?
I heard strike.
I'm out, sir.
All right, just on the back of a napkin, which we learned from Dan Wilde, it's not the place you want to form policies on.
Well, the Leffert curve. I was going to say the Leffert curve.
Yeah, so was I. So, but anyway,
needs to tighten that up.
All, like, we could ask for $600,000 each, I reckon. If you take the 8,400 downloads to how many downloads we get, and $107,000 to that, we could all be rich.
Well, I'll have to take your word for it, because that's... That math is too difficult for me. Yeah, but
which is why we want to move to North Carolina.
Apparently, yeah. Apparently £12 a download it costs the good people.
That's incredible. Like, I mean, one, that blows me away, the personal stories and memorable moments of exporting from Britain.
That's the personal reflections. Someone rings up like, yeah, I traded with a guy in France.
Memorable moments.
It was awesome because I made
when we signed that deal. We signed that deal. We went out for two beers and then went home.
Yeah. Great times. Now, so look, yeah. I mean, I'm happy to strike. I think, you know, you can be the front of the strike. Nina can be the one that's sort of
I want Nina
doing the intimidation behind the scenes.
Look at her eyes right now. She's just merely thinking about strike.
Imagine her screaming.
Yeah, I'm planning at the moment.
Planning at the moment?
Yep.
Good God.
Imagine her screaming.
With both of us dying.
Yeah, yeah, that's
terribly.
Right. Imagine her screaming scab as Rosner walks into the studio.
Again.
Scab! Anyway.
All right, cool.
We're on strike.
No, right, we're on strike. We're moving to North Carolina, and Nina is Titania McGrath. These are three things I want in show notes and I want us to reflect on next week.
Fantastic. What about two?
That is it for me. Unless you have anything more, I'm going to close out the show.
That's all we had.
All right, cool. So thank you guys so much for listening and downloading. Once again, available on all podcast apps. So if you do want to spread the word to family and friends, if they are starting to get into the world of podcasting, as so many Australians are, make sure you're doing that. If you are listening through the IPA website, that's awesome, but it's going to be more convenient for you and better for us if you make us part of your feed in iTunes or Stitcher or what is...
I've never even heard
Pocket,
of that one.
Pocket Casts, I think, is the one that Berg uses. I'm just an Apple Podcast guy. I'm a basic one like that. But anyway, so yeah, just make us part of your feed. Subscribe to us. It's all free and all good. But if you are listening to us through Apple Podcasts, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review and you can leave a note for the show. Maybe you have some more questions for Nina about her Titania McGrath updates. Nina / Titania, where can people go if they want to support the work of the IPA?
My Twitter account? No, jokes. Just visit ipadoc.au and click on that donate button if you'd like to donate, or if you'd like to become a member, or you have someone, a friend that you wish to become a member, just click on that join button and fill out the details, of course, and starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Sounds great to me. See you guys next week for episode 100.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I cherish you, my